Peak Wealth Management proudly presents Finding True Wealth with Nick Hopwood, where we believe by providing education and guidance, we help our clients make sound financial decisions, which ultimately puts them on a path towards their definition of true wealth. Now, here is your certified financial planner professional and founder of Peak Wealth Management, Nick Hopwood.
Welcome to Finding True Wealth. Today, we're going to be talking about private equity. And I've got a guest, Joe Ozarek, coming on, who I've been working with for like 10 years as a private equity consultant. He's, you know, basically behind the scenes, like a silent partner, if you will, helping educate me about the different products that are available in the marketplace and really educating us so we have the opportunity to make the best recommendation, you know, using our fiduciary standard to make sure that we put our clients ahead of ours and making the most suitable recommendations to people based on their circumstances. So we got 24 minutes with Joe. Hopefully you can learn a lot about private equity and hear some interesting stories from Joe's perspective as well. Without further ado, here is Joe. Okay, without further ado, I'd like to welcome Joe to the podcast. Welcome, Joe.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
So I've known Joe for like 10 years. He's been a great consultant as far as alternative investments go, primarily private equity, right?
Correct. Yep.
So tell me about how you got to be a private equity consultant.
Good question. It's definitely not something you esteem to become when you're a kid in high school. I think it was one of those, I was always interested in financial services. When I joined the private markets. I went to work for an investment firm in Philadelphia that was more on the traditional mutual fund, separate account side. Did some time, kind of started with them, changed a couple of firms, I've covered kind of everything from mutual funds to separate accounts, 401k plans, variable annuities, ETFs was with my last firm. One of the firms in between was my first introduction to alternative investments. I think just from the very beginning was attracted to the more sophisticated nature of hedge funds and private equity. And about 12, 13 years ago, stumbled into the firm I work for today through a recruiter.
And backing up one step before Philly, right? You attended college at?
I went to the United States Military Academy at West Point. So I spent 8 years in the Army, including time in school.
Outstanding. Now, quick side note. My in-laws last month were on a boat. They bought a boat in New York and they had to, or like in Connecticut or something, I don't even know, and they had to bring it back. And so they came up on this great loop going down the Hudson,
right.
And they sent me pictures, they texted me pictures of West Point down from the river, and it looked like a fortress. It looked really cool.
It was a fort. It was the American Revolutionary War, the attempt to stop the Brits from heading north up the Hudson. They stretched a chain actually across the entire Hudson River.
That's a really neat history. Now, I've heard other stories about, you know, West Point and horrible freshman experiences, like how hard it was, like shining your shoes and all this stuff by 6 a.m. Tell me something that you remember most about being, you know, in West Point.
Well, I mean, as a freshman, pretty much every minute of your day is accounted for, from the moment you wake up at 5:30 to lights out at midnight. Every single moment is pretty much accounted for. I think, you know, just a couple of funny things that stand out when you ask a question like that was, I can remember at one point in time thinking, if I didn't have to eat, this place wouldn't be so bad. Because all 4,000 cadets eat at lunch and the freshmen serve the upperclassmen. And it's a great opportunity for the upperclassmen to haze the underclassmen.
Of course, hazing doesn't exist, right?
Well, I mean, not physical hazing. I kind of equate first year at West Point as Hell Week when you join a fraternity, except there's no liquor involved.
Right.
That lasts a year.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing. So when I think private equity, first thing that comes to my mind is the old 1985 Wall Street movie, Wall Street, and we got Gordon Gekko and Michael Douglas.
Sure.
Greed is good and all that. It's kind of portraying private equity as a pretty scary place, right? Especially if your company's getting acquired, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's the entire private equity industry is really only 30 or 40 years old. And I would have told you, you know, 30 some years ago when Wall Street came out and Greed is Good, Gordon Gekko, a lot of stuff like that was occurring. I mean, there was a lot of low hanging fruit. They were doing primarily deals with very little equity and a lot of leverage. There's a lot of opportunities coming in, like they did in the movie, buy firms and break up the pieces and sell them for, you know, a bigger sum than they were worth.
And a lot of people lose their job.
And a lot of people lose their job. I think really then what I would have called leveraged buyouts over time morphed into management buyout, corporate buyout. Now we just call it buyout or private equity. And the emphasis on returns has really shifted from, you know, loading up on a bunch of leverage and breaking the company up into lots of pieces to operational improvements. Today, probably 85% of the total returns that we were talking about in private equity come from these managers coming in, buying these companies, and making them better. The company doesn't need to be in distress for private equity to be interested, nor can be a very well-run company. The private equity still sees an opportunity.
The key is they just see an opportunity that the existing management is not taking advantage of.
I always use a simple example. I mean, it's kind of a silly one, but let's say you have the best mattress manufacturer in the world. There's nothing they can do to make a better mattress, and they have perfect distribution. Private equity might buy them to sell pillows and blankets through the same distribution channels. Mm-hmm. So that's just kind of looking at things sometimes a little sideways. That said, it doesn't always mean that everyone's going to keep their jobs. I would tell you today, about half the time when private equity comes into a firm, the CEO and a lot of senior management may be replaced. The half that stays, by the time private equity is done with fixing the firm and making it better, a lot of times that management that was initially in place has been replaced as well. So there are still potential for positions to be lost as they kind of trim these companies up and make them leaner, meaner, and better.
So there are some similarities, but also a lot of differences.
Correct.
Going back to 1985.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing that interests me is that most people do not have access to private equity in their portfolios. And so it's kind of a new asset class.
For the private client, absolutely. I mean, private equity, when you look at it, has really been oriented towards institutional investment or institutional clients, corporate pension plans, foundations, endowments, sovereign wealth funds.
Yeah, you think of the Harvard endowment and the Yale endowment. I mean, they've been investing in private equity and alternatives for decades.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at kind of your average institution, will have 10-20% allocated to private equity. Your thought leaders like the Harvard, Yale endowments could be 30-40% invested in private equity. And your average private client, you and I, typically has less than 5%. And I would say realistically probably 0%.
Yeah, most people have zero. Yeah,
yeah, and the problem has been that when you go to these firms, the minimum investments are typically 5, 10, 20, sometimes $100 million. And corporate pension plans can play in that league. Most private clients cannot. What's changed over the years is the structure of how you can access private equity has changed to pretty dramatically. I would say maybe a dozen years back, 15 years back, some firms started creating feeder funds where ultra high net worth clients could get access to these deals, but you had to have $5 million in net worth, not including your primary residence, to participate. Mm-hmm. And you're usually still looking at a $250,000, $500,000 million minimum investment.
So you're looking at 0.1% of the population.
Right, or less.
Yeah.
In the last 4 or 5 years, with increased regulatory changes, there have been more registered funds, 40 Act funds that look and smell.
Which means?
It looks and smells a lot more like what you and I would consider a mutual fund. Mm-hmm. That's providing access to accredited investors, the $1 million net worth client, not including primary residents. So a much broader audience are now getting access through some of these registered products.
Exciting that some private individuals would be able to participate in private equity alongside of some of the endowments that you described.
Absolutely.
And if you have the requirement is a net worth of $1 million, not including your house.
Correct.
Right? So, Or an income
of $200,000 single, $300,000 joint for two of the last 3 years.
Okay.
That's the accredited investor.
So now you're probably into 1% of the population with an income like that, right?
Probably maybe
2%, yeah. Something like that.
Still a fraction, but yeah, a lot more than it's been able to participate in the past.
Yeah, that's right.
And by the way, these private equity managers are looking to find ways to get it in a mutual fund format. They want to figure out, how do I get into that defined contribution 401k business, which is a huge, trillion dollars in assets
that they could
participate in.
So we're seeing a trend here, I think. So originally, you'd have to have a certain net worth and a certain commitment of money and a 10-year commitment?
I would say on a direct private equity deal, you're looking at funds that are going to last the better part of 8 to 10 years. Where you're committing to a fund that's going to last 8 to 10 years, where you're probably locking up chunks of money for 3 to 5 years sort of investment windows over that time frame.
So that's it's a long time.
Correct. Absolutely.
So now you can participate if you have a smaller net worth. You can contribute or commit less money and commit for less time.
Correct. And we're getting better tax treatment. You know, on the direct deals, typically you're looking at a K-1. Institutions don't care about K-1s. For a high net worth private investor, that probably isn't going to mean you either have to amend your taxes or extend your taxes. A lot of people don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Some of the registered funds now are available in 1099. So they're IRA friendly, much more tax friendly.
That's pretty good.
That's great.
So back to the asset class, right? What makes private equity attractive for individuals and institutions? Like, why have they been doing it all?
I think the only reason you pay attention to private equity at all is because of returns. Your average private equity manager net of fees, and we should talk about what the fees are as well, is probably doing 3 to 5% better than the S&P on an annualized basis.
And that goes back to like 1985.
Back to mid-80s. I'm an old math guy. Statistically, that's a pretty big number. You and I'd have to take a hard look at. Your top quartile, top decile managers, some of these managers, when you get into the returns, can be doing 10, 20% better than the S&P on an annualized basis. So obviously, if we can get sort of continued exposure to these sorts of returns, we can move the needle for our portfolios. The reasons the institutions have 10, 20% or more allocated to these types of managers is because the returns are available there and they've got long-term investment horizons.
Those are some strong numbers.
Yeah.
And how are they doing that? Are they taking more risk? Are they, you know, playing in different sandboxes? I mean, what is it?
I don't think they're taking more risk. They're definitely, I think, playing in an expanded sandbox. I would tell you the entire private equity universe, and this is probably, you know, call it somewhere about a year old data, is about $3.9 trillion in assets globally, which is a big number, but not in the scheme of financial services, if you think about it. I mean, I think most people have heard of Fidelity Investments. Mm-hmm. That's a $7 trillion manager. BlackRock, if you've heard of them, is probably a $7 or $8 trillion manager, the largest asset manager in the world. The entire private equity universe is $3.9 trillion in assets. About 80% of that industry are what we call buyout funds, what we were discussing earlier. More stable companies, more consistent cash flow, where private equity sees an opportunity. The other 20% is all the other strategies you and I have heard about: venture capital, angel investing, early and late stage growth capital. There's been a bunch of kind of sector specific industry funds created. If you and I are talking venture capital, mm-hmm. which I consider a subset of private equity, we could be looking at a lot more zeros. You know, there's some big winners and there's a bunch of losers kind of in between. You kind of want to have exposure to all of them within a portfolio over time. Some of them are still pretty hard to get access to. Well, I think the real risk though in private equity is not necessarily loss of capital, and we can talk about why these guys don't lose money as frequently as maybe our public managers do. The real risk is the illiquidity premium. Mm-hmm. Can I pay you enough return for the fact you're giving up your daily liquidity? Which mm-hmm. I think is another kind of, you know, noteworthy topic of daily liquidity.
So as far as liquidity goes, we have, you know, your stocks and ETFs, which are intraday.
Yep.
You have your mutual funds, which are daily. You have some other types of funds, which are quarterly. And private equity, how does that work?
I mean, I would say typically on the scale, particularly the direct private equity investments, is on the very farthest end of the illiquid scale. Again, funds are going to last the better part of 10 years. The registered funds we mentioned earlier, a lot of them are now providing quarterly liquidity. So that's a lot better liquidity than we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
Still not daily. I still think, you know, when you're talking about private equity or private investments in general, if I can find managers that are bringing me enough of a return, maybe it's worthwhile conversation. I'd give up, you know, some of that daily liquidity for something a little bit less liquid for the extra return. And I carve out 10, 20% of portfolio for these alternative investments.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about the performance in the historical numbers for private equity. You know, what other kind of stats? You said that you like statistics. What other statistics are we looking at for the behavior of these types of funds in the asset class?
Well, the other point we didn't follow up on was the sandbox, the opportunity set.
Yeah.
When I started in this business in 94, there was about 7,200 publicly traded stocks in the U.S. By the late 90s, there was almost 8,000 publicly traded stocks.
Wow.
I think most people are pretty surprised to see over the last two decades that number's been cut by more than half. There's just over 3,500 public traded stocks in the U.S. today.
Is that because companies are going out of business, or they're getting bought mergers, or
all of the above? I mean, there's mergers. There's people, you know, businesses people going out of business. There's less IPOs. There's 80% less initial public offerings today than there was 20 years ago. So there's less companies coming public. Mm-hmm. There is more private capital out there, so these private industries can stay private longer. They want to stay private longer because increased regulation, activists. They don't want to have to answer to share, you know, to analysts every 90 days about, you know, their IT investment.
Yeah, you know, I just read this book from 1992, the Sam Walton autobiography. It's worth a read. And he says, you know, he made the decision to take Walmart public. And his wife was really upset because all their private information was now public.
Correct.
And now everyone knew this guy's the richest guy in the world in America at that time.
Right.
And he was getting letters and solicitations
for
everything because they just wanted a handout.
Well,
and she was kind of embarrassed that they were on the top of the Fortune list.
Yeah, you know? I understand. I mean, it's better to be kind of off the radar. I mean, think about the day and age we live in. I mean, there's a lot of tech out there. Going public could be potentially putting some trade secrets in the public eye that you don't want to share. Mm. There was a great article not long ago, and you're seeing it kind of happen again with some of these unicorns you and I were talking about earlier. 20 years ago, Amazon went public at $600 million. 20 years ago, that's what you did. You went public at $500 or $600 million because that's how you continue to grow the company. Today, Uber goes public at $100 billion. Who made the money between $600 million and $100 billion on Uber?
Venture.
That, you and I, in the public markets, it wasn't available. It was the private investors that made that money.
Yeah.
And we were just talking about, you know, Uber, Uber just went public.
Yeah. Beyond Meat, right?
Yeah, Beyond Meat, right? There was a great article probably a month or two ago when Uber went public that laid out all the capital calls, you know, or, you know, kind of fundraising that was done from kind of inception through IPO. And a lot of people made money on that deal on the private side.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean the stock won't do well on the public side, but a lot of the early gains.
The low-hanging fruit.
A lot of the early gains have been made.
Yeah. What about some of the other statistics about correlation to stocks and bonds and volatility and... You know, I tend to think of this as a new asset class for most people, so it's a true diversifier.
Yeah. A couple things. You know, from a correlation standpoint, private equity simply acts different than public equity. A handful of these managers have gone public. The analysts have a hard time coming up with estimates of earnings because this 20% incentive fee that these managers participate in comes in when the deals are realized, when they sell the company or when they take it public. And it's not a quarterly sort of, you know, continual growth that the analysts are looking to see. There was, you know, some of these registered funds I was talking about did fantastically in the fourth quarter. Markets were down 12, 13%, a lot of volatility. And some of these managers were up, you know, low single digits sort of returns.
They were up.
Ended the year up versus, you know, equity markets that ended down. But then first quarter of 2019, equity markets came screaming back and a lot of these managers were down, you know, not down, but up a lot less. And the same reason you loved them in the fourth quarter for protecting the downside is the same reason you got to love them in the first quarter, even though they didn't capture as much of the upside. And also, obviously, both 90-day windows, which we're not looking at investments on 90-day windows anymore, or we shouldn't be.
But what you're kind of illustrating is lower volatility
for sure. And part of that's the nature of private equity. These are illiquid investments.
They're not on the exchange every day.
They're not on the exchange. They're not reacting to Brexit or geopolitical risks or trade wars or, you know, with China or Mexico or, you know, tankers being bombed in the Middle East. These are every 90 days these managers mark to market their portfolios. Mm-hmm. The rules changed for private equity in 2008 with FASB 157. So every quarter now these private equity managers have to come in. End of the quarter, they mark their positions to what they think the fair market value is. They're looking at a whole bunch of different factors, including what the public equity managers are looking at and coming up with what they think is a fair price if I had to sell, but they're realized and unrealized losses. So you're just getting a lot less marks by nature. It's going to be a little bit less volatile, but the illiquid nature of the fund provides for a lot less volatility overall for the asset class.
So it sounds like there's a lot of positives compared to a traditional stock and bond portfolio where you're adding a new diversifier. You're adding potentially more returns, but you also have some negatives of some illiquidity.
You're giving up some liquidity, sure.
You have a different fee structure, right?
Yes, there's definitely more fees in here.
Yeah.
We should might as well address the fees now. So the way private equity's fees work, your typical private equity manager charges 1.5% annually, which is probably normal numbers we're used to seeing across a lot of our managers, plus 20% of the profits after an 8% preferred rate. So what does all that mean? When private equity manager sees XYZ company, they think there's a lot of opportunity, they go buy XYZ company. The average hold on these buyout funds is typically 3 to 5 years. Some will be quicker, some will be a little bit longer, but 3 to 5 is about average for them to kind of come in and do their thing and take the, you know, fix what they think is fixable and to kind of take it to the next level. They charge 1.5% each of those years that they hold the company, but the first 1.5% gains they make every year go to offset those management fees to the investor. Once that's achieved, this 8% preferred rate kicks in, which means the next 8% in gains go 100% to the investor, zero to the manager. Once that's been achieved, now we start splitting the profits 80-20, 80 investor, 20 manager. So when these private equity managers look at a company, they're doing a ton of due diligence and work on up front because they've got pretty big hurdles to overcome to get to the 20% incentive fees where they're really making their money.
That's where they make the real money.
Right.
Okay, very interesting. So you've been around these guys for a while now. There's got to be an exciting story you can tell about a great turn that someone made.
Sure.
Without getting into too many specifics.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about there was a an automotive company that was big into axles, heavy duty drivetrains, that kind of stuff. This is probably second Gulf War time I'm thinking about. It was owned by a private equity firm. From what I'm told, the deal wasn't going as expected with the current private equity manager. They were looking to take what they had and put it on auction and kind of just get out with what they could. Another private equity manager who had specialty in automotive was presenting their case to the investment committee. On that investment committee was also the team that worked on aerospace and defense. Aerospace defense team had just come back from the Pentagon, where they became privy to the fact that because of IEDs during the second Gulf War chewing up our troops, soldiers being the ingenious little creatures they are, started adding additional armor on their own to protect themselves in the vehicles. The vehicles were getting too heavy and they're breaking their axles and causing problems for the vehicles. So the Pentagon was going to put out for bid a whole new retrograde to the Army and Marine Corps ground units.
To give the soldiers more protection without breaking the axles.
To give them better armored vehicles that could support the heavier armor, yada, yada, yada. Said private equity manager superseded the auction, bought the automotive company, won the government contracts. See if I can remember these numbers correctly. Over the next 3 years, they increased the firm's product lineup from 2 to 49, increased production of axles from 4,000 a month to 8,000 a month, doubled the employee base from 300 employees to 600 employees. So here, a perfect example of not really necessarily cutting a lot of people, but adding to the employee base. Increased revenue from government contract from 16% to over 60%. Sold to a big conglomerate 3 years later for 3.7 times what they paid for it.
That's a good story.
That's a great story.
I think a lot of people would remember hearing the headlines of, going into Iraq and Afghanistan and all these guys, all the landmines and all the RPGs and everything, it's horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, and just part of the nature of private equity is these networks of access. Yeah. I mean, private equity manager just happened to come back from the Pentagon and was aware of government contracts coming to market. I mean, there's no, nothing necessarily secret there, but they were just aware of something, before someone else was and saw an opportunity and this automotive company was able to go in and take over that position and improve the company dramatically in a matter of 3 years, sell for a big profit.
And the headlines started becoming more scarce about soldiers blowing up.
I mean, there's the enemy continues to, change their battle plans, and we continue to try to adjust to ours as well.
Absolutely. So, Joe, we talked about how this can be nice for certain people. Who should be considering this and who shouldn't, right? Besides just the net worth requirements.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not really necessarily super worried about these managers losing a lot of money. If we start talking venture, then maybe we're having a different conversation. These guys are getting a lot more information than you and I get in the public markets before they ever decide to buy. The real risk, as we mentioned, is really this illiquidity premium. A couple of things that just off the top of my head, if we're looking at a direct deal with a you know, the fund's going to last 8 to 10 years. That's a factor for certainly for older clients. These new registered funds with quarterly liquidity takes a lot of that off the table. Mm-hmm. I simply think, I think the conversation is a natural continuum to everything you and I have been doing in public equities. We really haven't had vehicles until more recently that could even get us into the private equity space. Mm-hmm. Now we've got some of these registered products that's getting, you know, our accredited investors access to these at $50,000 minimums, $25,000 minimums versus $250,000, $500,000, or trying to go direct at $5, $10, $20 million. So I think there's a lot of positives. I guess, you know, the other thing that comes to mind is if you think the next 10 years are going to be similar to the last 10 years, then you could probably make the case why give up liquidity. I can get the returns right. I want from the public markets.
But we just don't know.
We don't know. And you know, we're 10 years into an expansion. I think, you know, most folks out there think there's probably more upside risk, you know, or less upside opportunity than downside risk.
Yeah. Are we in 1995 or 1999?
No idea. Right. And definitely not a global guy. So I think that, you know, the old adage goes in our business, the only free lunch is diversification. This is another way to keep our clients in equities, take some of maybe the long-only risk off the table from public markets and get them exposure to some asset classes in private markets they haven't been able to get to.
Outstanding. Hey, Joe, it's been great having you on the podcast today. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Great stuff from Joe. I loved hearing the story about the IEDs in Iraq and also the opportunity set of the number of public companies today versus 20 years ago. And you know, how many more private companies there are than stocks on the exchange. You know, it's truly a different asset class and an added diversifier as a potential portfolio. So thanks for listening. If you have interest in speaking further about this type of investment, please reach us at peakwm.com and subscribe to the podcast at findingtruewealth.podbean.com.